Second case today is United States v. Adams. Appellant prepared to argue?
Yes, sir.
Government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Appellant may argue.
Yes, sir. Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court, I am Frank Spinner, retained civilian counsel for Sergeant Adams. And, of course, my co-counsel here, Captain Alex Hess, as he just argued, McPherson. I'd like to begin by making it clear that we do have some different issues in Adams that did not exist in McPherson. And that's where, because of the limited time that I had to argue, and I sat through the last argument, I intend to focus on what is footnote 14 of the Army Court's opinion, and then perhaps address a few other areas, for instance, the potential remedy or relief, if the court does grant relief, whether we would go for whether the Army Court can reassess, whether we have a rehearing.
Could you speak up just a little bit?
Yes, sir. Here's the deal with note 14 and why it's so important in the Adams case, which I'm sure is obvious to the court. There were a number of specifications that the Army Court said did not come into play with respect to if relief is granted based on the statute of limitations. And I believe that the court's analysis in a footnote falls far short of what is required, and I think it's an error as well. In other words, we are asking the court to include the remaining specifications and the Article 125 sodomy specification and give it the same treatment as the other specification that the court addressed, as well as those in McPherson. In that regard, when you look at the specification of, when you look at note 14, they disagree about the savings clause, Article 43G of the UCMJ. And they seem to say that if the allegations of the specifications are changed in some way, even if, as it says in Article 33, if they're defective or insufficient for any cause, then you return to the original statute of limitations. I mean, that's basically, it's a savings clause under Article 43G. I would like to point out in the joint appendix that at trial, and I may just throw in that I, at the rehearing, I was counsel at the rehearing. I started out with Adams in the original appeal. It was reversed under U.S. v. Hills. Then we went back for the rehearing. I represented him at the rehearing, and then after we did have some findings of guilty, as you know, and so I'm back here now on appeal for him again. But if you look at Joint Appendix, page 219, there is a chart or a graph that the government provided at trial in which they effectively say that the specifications that are in question here in Note 14, that they're the same offenses that were, even though there might have been minor word choice changes, which is noted in footnote 14, they're basically the same offenses. And so our argument is that when you look at the savings clause under 43G, and let me just read it out loud, if charges or specifications are dismissed, and we're arguing that the original charges were dismissed by the convening authority, as defective or insufficient for any cause, and the period prescribed by the applicable statute of limitations has expired, then you go down to additional part of the paragraph. Well, we're saying that the charges were dismissed, they were not dismissed because they were defective in any way, and they were not insufficient. And to the extent that the prosecutors in the rehearing may have recommended that they change some of the language in those specifications, that language was inconsequential. And what the Army Court of Criminal Appeals failed to do is they failed to take each specification and address how Article 43G applied to it.
Well, now I'm getting confused.
Okay.
If, in fact, the specs are the same, which I think you just argued, If the specs are essentially the same, absent minor word doodling.
Right.
Then it would seem that the same statute of limitations would apply.
Here's the problem.
Lost here.
When the case was sent back for rehearing, you had the 2012 charges supposed to be reheard. The government elected, and I'm not going to try to justify why they did it, they elected to draft a new set of specifications. And then they had a new Article 32 hearing, and so basically you had the same or similar specifications in the new set of charges. So we have a situation where we have two sets of similar or same charges going forward to the convening authority. Now, in a normal rehearing, there's no requirement to hold another Article 32 proceeding. But in this case, the government elected to do that, where there was no requirement to do so. So when the charges, the original 2012 charges and the new 2017 charges, when they arrive at the desk of the convening authority sets aside or dismisses, I'm sorry, and this was one of the issues in our where we have disagreement with the government, they treated them as though they were withdrawn. We are arguing that no, they were dismissed, and there should be no contest about whether they were dismissed. So the 2012 charges are dismissed. Once they're dismissed, they're dead. They're gone. And the statute of limitations now applies. And, of course, what we were arguing consistent with McPherson is it resorted back to a five-year statute of limitations for these specific specifications addressed in footnote 14.
Okay, are you relying on the savings clause in 43?
Right, we're saying...
But that requires that they be dismissed for some defect. And what you're saying is there wasn't any defect, so where's the savings clause?
Right, so the savings clause doesn't kick in.
Okay, the savings clause doesn't kick in.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
You're saying, yes, they were dismissed, but no, they were not dismissed for cause.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Well, finish your sentence, please, and then I'll ask my question.
Well, and the court in the footnote says they cite Article 43G to justify that the savings clause applies, and they italicize for any cause, but they have to be insufficient or defective before any cause applies. Yes, sir.
I just wanted to ask two questions about that clause, defective or insufficient for any cause. One question is, what is the definition of that? There's very little case law on it, and if we're going to say, well, they weren't defective or insufficient, I think we'll have to define it. I want to know how to define it. And then the second question is, how does it make sense that specifications that are dismissed because they're defective and then re-preferred in a correct way are treated better than specifications that aren't defective? That just seems very odd to me.
Your Honor, I have very little hair left on my head, and there are things that I read over and over again that makes me scratch my head and lose more hair. And the question you pose, I don't have an answer to it. It makes no sense to me, okay? And I've been practicing military law now for 45-plus years. I have never seen this question arise in that 45 years, that trial or on appeal. But here's the way I sort of back into this issue a different way. I say, well, these are limiting factors before you get the savings clause. If someone could have written it and said, for any cause, if the language is changed in a specification, then the savings clause applies. Now, would that make sense? I'm not saying it would. But I'm saying they put these limiting terms in here, and as you say, there's very little law that tells us what they mean. All I can do is say, in this case, number one, there was no requirement to come up with a new charge sheet. Absolutely none. I've done rehearings. The appellate court sends the case back down, you do a rehearing, and you have your charge sheet. You don't have to do an Article 32, you set a trial date. The convening authority refers it to a new panel. So in this case, I think sort of like Congress bollocked up Article 43, the trial counsel bollocked up the charge sheet by doing it this way. They very simply, and when you look at some of the case law, they very simply could have just made an amendment to the charge sheet before referral. In other words, for instance, the one specification, charge two specification one, the old charge identified it as a indecent liberty. The new charge, the only change they said is it's an indecent act. But it's the same misconduct in terms of the factual allegations, so they only changed that. And as you look at page JA-219, they say here that it's the same misconduct, first of all. I mean, just by changing it from liberty to act, they both come under Article 134, and they're basically the same offense. So the Army Corps says, well, that is insufficient for any cause. And there's no insufficiency. They could have left it as liberty. In the original trial, he was convicted of that specification. And on appeal, nobody said this is insufficient because it says liberty instead of act, and they changed it to act. On the Article 125, sodomy specification, there was no change at all. So the Army Corps seems to be saying that if some of the specifications have had changes to them that are either defective or insufficient, then you can change any other specification that's not defective or insufficient. So I think if there's anything I'm trying to do in the limited time that I have to argue, is go back and look very closely at each specification. As you look at them, the relevant pages are, as I said, JA-219, where they go through the old charge and the new charge, and they say this is the change we made, and this is the reason we made it. But in each one of them, they say this is the same misconduct. And so if you bless this mess, if you bless what the Army Court did, then you're basically saying any prosecutor, when a case is sent back for rehearing, can simply make any minor change, a word here or a word there, and they get the old statute of limitations. I mean, that's basically what they're saying here. One of the other ones that the Army Court, I think, got wrong, the language that changed was that language was deleted. And in effect, what they were saying is this language is surplusage. And so at the trial level, 2012 charge sheet has more language than what the government needed to prove their offense. Or they said, we don't have the evidence to prove this additional language. So in the 2017 change, they simply deleted that language. Well, how does something become defective or insufficient by deleting language from it? That makes no sense. So the Army Court, I mean, I guess I was surprised that they buried this in a footnote when I read the opinion. They buried this in a footnote, and they did not make any detailed analysis of what the changes were and how Article 43G acted as a savings clause for the original statute of limitations. So we're asking, in a nutshell, we're asking this court to take Article 43G, the savings clause, and say that the Army Court erred in saying that the original statute of limitations was preserved by the acts taken by the government in this case.
Mr. Spinner, for I think it was this, the 125 one that had no changes at all.
Right.
Don't we have an older case that says, look, it doesn't have to be the same piece of paper so long as it's the same charge? And in that one, it seems like it's highly technical to say that he wasn't charged with that within the period of limitations, given that he was charged. Now, I agree that it had been dismissed and then refiled, but since there's no change to it.
Well, right, but that goes back to, does the dismissal mean something or does it not? Why did they dismiss it to begin with? In other words, if they had simply taken the original charges that were set back for a rehearing, they would have not had to make any change to that charge and specification. But they created the problem, like Congress created a problem with Article 43, they created the problem by dismissing that. Now, they did not see or anticipate that, oh, wait a minute, there's been changes in the statute of limitations, and there's this whole problem over here that we're walking right into without knowing it. And now we want the court to say, well, it's the same charge. Who cares if it was dismissed or not? That doesn't matter. Well, except you run into 43G that says, yes, it does matter because you dismissed the charge that you had that you could have walked into a new rehearing with, and you dismissed it. And that's the impact of a dismissal. And none of this was explained to the convening authority. When you go back and read the staff judge affidavit's pretrial advice on the rehearing, crickets. They don't even tell the convening authority, well, this is what we're doing, this is why we did it. That we in the joint appendix, we have the staff judge advocate's advice as well as he testified. And they, no effort was undertaken whatsoever to explain to the staff, to the convening authority, this is what we're doing and this is why we're doing it. So, I just have a few seconds left, unless there's another question on it. I think my position is pretty clear. I mean, it's very simple and straightforward. And so I just want to make clear that we didn't make it clear in our brief, and I know I'll get a rebuttal, but we are asking for if you grant relief based on McPherson in this case, we're asking for a rehearing on sentence. The landscape has changed. Sentencing landscape has changed, and we're asking for a rehearing. We're not asking you to send it back to the Army Corps for reassessment. And my time has expired.
Thank you, counsel.
Yes, sir.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, honorable judges of this court, may it please the court. My name is Captain T.J. Dharmapal, and together alongside Lieutenant Colonel Wayne Williams, I represent the United States. At the outset, the 2016 amendments to the Uniform Code of Military Justice did not retroactively make the statute of limitations for the relevant offenses in this case, specifically indecent liberties with a child and sodomy of a child, 5 years. Congress has only ever enlarged the statute of limitations for child abuse offenses. Accordingly, to adopt appellant's position that the statute of limitations for these offenses would revert to 5 years would lead to an absurd result demonstrably contrary to the legislative purpose and intent. The context of the legislation tells us that Congress did not intend to eradicate from the lexicon of child abuse offenses sodomy of a child and indecent liberties with a child, thereby curtailing their timely prosecution.
Counsel, on that point, is any error absurd? And if we agree that it's an error, does that necessarily make it absurd?
I think the result is what would be absurd, Your Honor. The result being that these offenses, which have and always will constitute child abuse offenses, are all of a sudden not child abuse offenses.
What about the fact that for most of the period of the UCMJ, the period of limitation for these offenses was 5 years?
Pardon me, was the last?
For most of the period of the UCMJ, the period of limitations was 5 years. It was only after 2003, I believe, that they were made longer. So are you saying that it's a five-year period is just absurd for this kind of offense, or are you saying that it's absurd to make the period go shorter?
It is absurd to make the period for the statute to revert to a period of 5 years, because if we look at every time Congress has touched the statute of limitations, they have elongated it. And in the case at hand, we look at these charges, and this goes directly to Mr. Spinner's proposition, that the charges, when they were received in 2012, were timely received. It was the law in effect at the time was until the victim attained the age of 25. In 2012, the victim was 17 years old when she testified, or when the charges were received by the summary court-martial convening authority. She was under 25. Even in 2017, if you look at the dismissal and preferral, the situation that Mr. Spinner was referring to, the charges were still timely received at that time because she was only 22 at the time the charges were received by the summary court-martial convening authority on 11 May 2017. So under either case, these charges were timely received in these circumstances.
Well, it's one thing to say that as a matter of statutory construction, we win. It's another thing to say that as a matter of statutory absurdity, we win. You look at the plain words of the statute. My understanding of absurdity is that it's kind of a last-ditch doctrine to be applied only in the most extreme cases. And in something like the statutes of limitation under the code, which have been fiddled with unmercifully for the last 20 years, to say that as a matter of statutory construction, or as a matter of, you know, as a matter of statutory construction, we win. Okay. But to say that it's simply absurd sounds to me like an argument from legislative history, of which there's damned little, masquerading as absurdity. Congress couldn't have intended this. Congress does stuff all the time it doesn't intend, because this is a part of the DOD authorization bill, the biggest piece of legislation that plows its way through Congress every year. It gets about 200 amendments on the floor. Believe me, is there room for error in there? You bet. That's not statutory absurdity. That may be error. That may be, but this argument to me just sounds like, oh, Congress couldn't have intended that, which is an argument from legislative intent, hardly an argument from absurdity.
Your Honor, I would pose to this Court that, especially when we look back at Briggs, when we look at the context, if there's one thing that is for certain, Congress has always intended to protect children and the rights of victims. And in this scenario,
2003.
Yes, Your Honor, since they began elongating
the statute. Since they began stirring in this pot.
Yes, Your Honor, and that is what is relevant to this case here today in looking at the appellant's offenses, which occurred from 2003 to 2005.
Right, but it sounds to me like you're arguing a kind of sketchy legislative intent.
No, Your Honor, I wouldn't say that there is sketchy legislative intent. I think it's very clear.
Well, is there report language that goes to this? In the bill, in the conference report?
Not off the top of my head that I know of.
Okay, well, then there's precious little legislative indication of legislative intent. I'm not trying to argue. I'm not trying to put forth the proposition that there's some evil cabal of child abusers in Congress. I'm trying to say that this is an argument on legislative intent. And that there's very little evidence of legislative intent, and that given the burps and leaks in the legislative process, it's by no means absurd that some result like this could have turned up. Now, how do you answer that?
I think that the result itself is absurd to reach the result that appellant specifically is asking for, specifically that the statute of limitations, as he put in his brief, reverts to 5 years.
Well, what you're saying is the appellant makes it absurd by reading it and asking for what he says he's entitled to under the statute. I'm not at all sure of that. It just seems to me that this is not an absurdity situation. This is a legislative intent situation. And you can argue legislative intent, and you can say Congress couldn't have intended this, but that doesn't make it absurd.
I think it was alluded to earlier, Your Honor, that it is simply unfathomable that inserting your penis into a child's anus, that Congress would have intended for inserting your penis into a child's anus to have a statute of limitations of 5 years, whereas inserting your penis into a child's vagina would have an elongated statute of limitations period. That cannot be the result that Congress intended. And that
it may not be the result that Congress intended, but if they wrote it that way, and I'm not saying they did, but if they did, then don't we have to live with it?
No, Your Honor. I think that this Court can interpret the language, and I would...
No, you're saying that we can toss the language because Congress couldn't have intended that, and you're back into absurdity, because we don't toss language just because Congress could, because of what we think congressional intent is. You don't do it that way.
Yes, Your Honor, and I agree to the extent that this would be a third, the third option, or the third avenue, which the Army Court defaulted to, Panel 2 did when they determined that it would be absurd. But there is, as mentioned in McPherson earlier, and as the thrust of appellant's argument in Adams put forth in the brief, with the language of constitutes, there is language available such that these offenses, the reading of the government is not that it reverted to 5 years. When the government reads Article 43, the plain language, it's that these offenses, if we're talking about what constitutes child abuse, absolutely constitute child abuse.
All right. Then there's your answer. Then what are we yammering about absurdity for?
Because the ACCA
yammered about absurdity.
But yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Highlighting the untenable nature of appellant's request, and specifically to address, again, the 2012 versus the 2016 when the charges were told, these charges were always timely received. And the government stands by the Army Court's opinion on pages 3 through 6 in talking about the actions by the convening authority. Article 43 Gulf allows for changes for any cause.
That's not what it says. Read it again.
Your Honor, specifically 43G1?
I don't think it says that, right? It doesn't. It says are defective or insufficient for any cause. But that's the question, right? That's what we're faced with. How were these charges, for the saving clause to apply, the charges had to be defective or inefficient? Now, maybe we don't know what that means. Maybe that's a very low bar. Maybe it's very high. It's not for any cause. They had to be defective or inefficient. Or maybe you're just telling us, ignore those words. They're total surpluses. They don't matter. What is the government's answer in this case for how these charges were deficient or ineffective, especially given that one of them was refiled word for word identical?
Your Honor, I think that in two ways the government prevails on this matter. First is that the convening authority is well within his discretion to dismiss and prefer charges anew, in this case as it was a rehearing. And therefore, when we go to 43 Gulf, and I believe the government referred to it as inconsequential in its brief, to the essential foundation of the argument that 43 Gulf, the changes or amendments that were made to the language, to the date ranges, would constitute a change, albeit minor. And that may speak more to...
Well, you can't have it both ways. They can't be minor and be defective.
Yeah, agreed, Your Honor.
Well, I think Judge Hardy has a point.
Were the charges defective?
The charges were not per se defective. There were differences in the dates that were made.
All right, let me ask again. Were the charges defective?
Yes, Your Honor. An argument can be made that they were defective.
How were they defective?
In that the date ranges were incorrect or not as accurate as they could be.
So that's the government's position. The charges were defective because the date ranges were incorrect.
Yes, Your Honor.
And were they insufficient?
Insufficient to the extent that the date ranges were not correct.
For the same reason. So the fact that the date range is incorrect made the charges deficient. Insufficient.
Sorry.
And that is why the saving clause applied. That's the government's position.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, it seems to me like... Oh, I'm sorry.
Please go ahead.
Go ahead, John.
It seems to me that you have the choice of calling them defective or insufficient. You're using both? You're going to say both provisions apply? Or it would seem that you're better argument would be that the offenses as drafted in 2012 were insufficient because they no longer captured the true period of the criminal acts.
Yes, Your Honor, that is more accurate to say.
All right, that's one argument, but I still don't follow your defective argument, unless you mean defective and insufficient or the same thing.
I'm using them synonymously, and I should not, or they are.
Yeah, you can't do that because that would give no meaning to the other word.
Yeah, yes, Your Honor, I'm using them in terms of they were not sufficient.
Counsel, do you need the savings clause here? I mean, suppose we just say, look, that savings clause says even if you made a mistake, you can correct it. But do you need the savings clause here?
No, Your Honor. We do not need the savings clause to prevail in this case because in 2012 the charges were timely received, and in 2016 the charges were timely received.
Well, let's suppose we disagree with you on the statute of limitations so that they need to be saved. But my question is, they were okay when they were filed, and you didn't change them. They're on a different piece of paper.
Right.
Now, Mr. Spinner says, yeah, but they were dismissed and then refiled. And the only way we can get to that conclusion is if we sort of pretend that dismissal didn't occur or had no significance. And so my question is, did the dismissal have significance? Assuming that the statute, we disagree with you on the statute of limitations, and so that they have to have been continued, is there any way, other than through 43G, that they can be continued?
Yes, Your Honor, a moment to...
I mean, for example, if there were minor amendments, I mean, if somebody had just made minor amendments and asked for leave to make those and there was no objection, that would be fine. But that didn't happen. So is there some other way it could be?
I apologize. I may not be understanding your question fully, Your Honor.
Well, my question is this. If, for example, trial counsel had brought the charges back and had moved to change the language to make minor changes to the specifications to conform the dates, and there was no objection by defense counsel, that would have been fine. You wouldn't need a savings clause under 43G. The statute of limitations just wouldn't be an issue. And this may well have been what trial counsel was trying to do. They just did it in a funny way by dismissing and re-preferring. And I'm just asking, is there any authority out there that says we can kind of ignore the dismissal and look at the substance that essentially they just slightly amended the charges, which was something they could have done, presumably, without dismissing them?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that may be hearkening to Moore. Yes, Your Honor.
But in that case, isn't that case different because they didn't dismiss the charges?
I don't recall exactly whether they dismissed the charges, but I, to the extent that they made minor amendments, Your Honor, these cases would be similar in that respect.
Thank you.
Pending any further questions from the court, the government requests that this court affirm the Army Corps.
Yeah, I have a question. It would seem that you were suggesting in your response to Judge Banks is that the dismissal is not an important step in the processing of charges in the military justice system. I mean, we have a whole rash of cases that, you know, contest about how the charges were dismissed, and what is the consequence of dismissing them. So it seems like dismissing charges is a significant act. Now, whether the trial counsel, the SJA, or whoever else is involved here understood that would be irrelevant, it seems. I mean, isn't dismissal of charges a fairly significant feature of the military justice system in processing charges?
Yes, Your Honor.
You'd agree with me there?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. But so shouldn't the dismissal in this case have some consequence? I mean, I don't see how you can say that dismissing the charges is just like making a pen and ink change to the specifications. That's where I'm stuck at. Now, you may have explained it, and I just didn't get it. That's always a possibility. But could you help me out here?
Yes, Your Honor. And as the government has posed before, when we examine this argument, the government is doing so in the context of the reversion if the period reverted to 5 years. Because to answer your question, what the convening authority did was well within his authority, and I believe there is a plethora of case law out there supporting what he did, because it is...
Sure, I'm not suggesting he can't do it. I'm suggesting, as I think Mr. Spinner is suggesting, that that had a consequence, whether anybody foresaw it at the time or not.
I would pose that it did not have any consequence because it was still timely received, because the statute of limitations had not expired for those offenses.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
If I may jump...
Rebuttal?
Yes, sir. Jump on that point. When they were dismissed, when the charges were dismissed, then the statute of limitations kicked in for 5 years. That's our argument on these charges. So the fact that whether they were timely received or not has no bearing on the new charges whatsoever, because they were received in 2017. So our point is that through this evolution of how these charges were preferred, investigated, and referred, Adams, I guess, by default, ended up with a 5-year statute of limitations, assuming McPherson, the court, follows the ruling of McPherson and adopts that. I do want to correct one thing, though. The specifications, there was no time issue on those specifications. So to the extent government counsel argued that that was a sufficient basis for change because the times changed, they didn't change. What happened, and I think you may have misread the case file, is that when we went to the rehearing, they had put 30 May down as a date, and they had to amend that to 3 May, the time period, the ending time period in each of those specifications. So it was an amendment at trial to correct a typographical error on the date. So the date time frame for each of those specifications is the same in both sets of charges. They weren't changing the new charges for a new time frame. So that's erroneous. And that does not rise to the level of a insufficiency or defectiveness. To go back to something, Judge Stuckey, going back now to the McPherson issue, I want to make 2 points. First of all, Bostock, I think, is very important. I read it again last night. And I don't have the exact page. I have page 24 of the slip-op opinion. But the Supreme Court says in Bostock, this court has explained many times over, many years, that when the meaning of the statute's terms is plain, our job is at an end. And further down on the same page, it says, the fact that a statute has been applied in situations not expressly anticipated by Congress does not demonstrate ambiguity. Instead, it simply demonstrates the breadth of a legislative command. And here's what happened. By making their statutes retroactive, they stepped into a minefield. I mean, that's very broad when you say retroactivity. That is broad and expansive. And so I think if you want to follow Bostock, the principle and the reasoning of Bostock, you have to say that, yes, this may not have been expressly anticipated by Congress, but too bad, so sad, government. Then finally he adds, Justice Gorsuch, it is ultimately the provisions of those legislative commands rather than the principal concerns of our legislators by which we are governed. What the government's arguing here is the principal concerns of the legislators were to expand the statute of limitations in child sex offenses. Well, that may have been their principal concern, but their language didn't correspond to that concern. And then I would close with this from Justice Story, and I think this is in our brief, and it goes again, Judge Stuckey, to what you're talking about and given your legislative experience. absurdity has to be so monstrous, in other words, the whatever the legislative language is and whatever they failed to do for a court, an appellate court to step in, overturning a statute's plain meaning must be so monstrous, I'm sorry, I'm getting tongue-tied here, that all mankind would rise up and reject it. Would all mankind rise up and reject this simply because...
Simply because what? That a 10-year-old has been sexually abused by her biological father, and at the time that that occurred, the statute of limitations still permitted prosecution of that offense. And because of the complexity in this area of the law, Congress engaged in a drafter's error and is divesting the government of the responsibility or the ability to prosecute. That is not a monstrous result to have a 10-year-old sexually abused by a biological father and can no longer prosecute?
Your Honor, with all due respect, you don't look at the offense when interpreting a statute. You don't look at how, at the monstrosity of
but
the victim that
could the very nature of the absurdity doctrine is not to focus on process and say, well, it's not absurd that there would be problems because this process is complicated. That's not the issue. The issue is not what the plain language says, because the absurdity doctrine only applies in those instances.
Let me address it another way. Over here you have common sense. And we talk about
exactly
when legislatures pass laws, hopefully we see some degree of common sense. Hopefully. I would dare say that's not always the case. As Nancy Pelosi said, you know, we'll know what it says after we pass it. That's sometimes the legislative model, I believe, in our current era. And over here you have absurdity. So you have common sense, you have absurdity. We are in that area in between that says it's not logical, perhaps. It doesn't make common sense that they would have done this and used this language, but it's not absurd. So you can have an area, and I submit that's
and
what you
that's where
that's where
you that's where the issue comes down to.
Right. And
whether it is absurd that Congress would divest the government of the ability to prosecute this type of sexual
offense. They didn't say that they're barred from prosecuting. They just said it reverts back to the original 5-year statute of limitations, and the government, by dismissing the original charges, pushed this case into that arena.
And that's the distinction between McPherson and this
case. Yes, exactly, Your Honor.
Thank you. I see your time has expired.
Thank you, counsel.
Yes, sir.
Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and the court is in recess pending further order of the court.